The Guardian.
Alors, ma chère Bissou, Nare 17, sans en aller boire.
The LRA attacked our village on the 17th of September 2008, very early in the morning. They started capturing people, catching them and killing them, not with firearms, but with machetes and clubs. I ran to my house as I had left everything there. When I got there, I realized it was burning. There was nothing left.
I came to Duru to escape the atrocities of the LRA. They started at the market where they stole a lot of goods. They went to the hospital where they captured people. Afterwards, they went to the school where they captured all the children from all the classes. They captured them and took them to the forest.
Welcome to The Guardian's Global Development Podcast. I'm Annie Kelly, and we just heard some voices from communities directly affected by Lord's Resistance Army violence in northeastern Democratic Republic of Congo. Today we're here to discuss the Kony 2012 campaign, which calls for the capture of LRA leader Joseph Kony, and which has become a global phenomenon over the past few weeks. The campaign culminates in a global day of action on April 20th, when organisers are urging people all over the world to put up posters of Kony designed to draw attention to his crimes, and they're calling for him to be captured and brought to the ICC. But the campaign has faced a backlash of criticism for inaccuracies, oversimplifications, and particularly for its central claim that the only way to stop the LRA is through US-backed military action. Today we'll be discussing whether this is the right approach to such a complex and long-running conflict and ask what the alternatives are. Here with me in the studio is Andy Carl, director of the UK-based NGO Conciliation Resources, which has done a lot of work on the LRA, and Amanda Weisbaum from the NGO War Child, which also works in Uganda and Central African Republic. And down the line from Kampala, we're joined by Professor Mahmoud Mandani, Executive Director of the Makerere Institute of Social Research at Makerere University. Welcome to you all. Kony 2012 pushes for military action to capture Kony. Amanda and Andy, do you both support getting Kony before the International Criminal Court? And how is this going to happen without sending in a military force to capture him, particularly when there are so many children surrounding Kony? Amanda?
I do believe that it's correct to get Kony to the ICC. I think it's an important part of the process, but it is only part of the process. The main function is to ensure that the children and young people are reconciled with their communities in the areas that the LRA has been.
I suppose what's more important to us is that there is an end and a resolution to the conflict. And our primary concern is that what it's going to take is not just a military intervention, but a more comprehensive response.
So you're not averse to a military intervention to put an end to LRA activities?
No, I think the military has a key role to play, both to protect the communities and to engage with the LRA. But the issue is that the military strategy should be part of a wider, comprehensive strategy that involves a humanitarian dimension and a diplomatic dimension, and not the other way around.
So are you in broad agreement with the Kony 2012 approach of military action first in order to actually go in and actually capture Kony?
No, I think that we think it is really irresponsible at this point in time to have a military operation in the midst of a humanitarian crisis.
Professor Mandani, can you add your thoughts on whether you support getting Kony before the International Criminal Court?
This story is at least 15, 20 years old. This question came up even actually before 1994, before the LRA. It came up at the time of the Holy Spirit movement. And I'd like to just take a sort of a historical view of this. When the NRA came into power in Uganda in 1986, there were numerous militias, remnants of armed powers of different dictatorships, like the Amin regime. They had committed atrocities far worse in terms of the numbers of people killed and mutilated than the LRA is accused of having done. And yet the way forward in 1986 in Uganda was not a military campaign, but was actually what was called a broad base. And the broad base was basically a political resolution of each of these conflicts. The political agreements were based on one, demilitarization, giving up arms as a way of achieving your objectives. But number two, not giving up your objectives. So every group which agreed to give up arms but not its objectives shared in the power. I don't think that we need a political and a military solution. I think that the solution has to be political.
So a question now from our global development website, TalkPoint, from Resolution Possible, who asks, is ICC justice what local people want? Have the ICC warrants stood in the way of the potential for local reconciliation and justice? Andy?
I think that the local people have led on the issues of justice and reconciliation. Local people are the very much the first line of response. And if you look at the real challenge for, it's been about the return of all these combatants and dealing with them and dealing with the specific cases. And in that, the ICC is not relevant and hasn't really played a role. What I understand is that many people in Uganda welcomed the call from the ICC at the time. They welcomed the idea that Joseph Kony and other leaders of the LRA would be tried in The Hague. In practice, it had presented a huge challenge when peace talks finally started some years back in Juba.
Yeah.
And it remained the largest obstacle to a resolution. And it was, in fact, the issue around which the talks collapsed when they launched the latest military offensive, Operation Lightning Thunder, 3 years ago.
What lessons can we learn from those 2006 Juba peace talks? How do you think that... How can we bring Kony to the table?
I think there are lots of lessons to be learned in the last 26 years of the war, and part of it have been the peaceful responses or the political responses. One of the most effective tactics was the Ugandan amnesty law, which led to the return of tens of thousands of returnees, abductees. It was much more effective than the counterinsurgency tactics, which put almost a million civilians into camps.
Professor Mamdani, can you tell me a bit about what you believe the Juba peace talks brought up for people in Uganda?
Well, I'd like to add two things to this discussion. One is that there is no single Ugandan point of view. Like any society, Uganda and views in Uganda are driven by a debate. And there are several Ugandan points of views. The second issue is that I think we should be quite clear about the circumstances in which the ICC came into Uganda. And that circumstance was the amnesty law. The Ugandan parliament had decided to extend amnesty to the leadership of the LRA. The president was opposed to it, but the president was trumped by a parliamentary law. It is in this context that the ICC came in, and the ICC undercut democratic processes within the country. That, I think, cannot be forgotten.
Well, now we're actually going to hear voices from Kampala. We're hearing from Richard Kavuma, the editor of the Observer newspaper in Kampala, who spoke to my colleague Celeste Hicks.
Previously, the opposition to a military solution to the problem was because many of the people who made up the numbers in the LRA were children who had been abducted by the rebels because, you know, the government could not protect them. So every time there was a choice between a military option and a peaceful solution, for instance, the argument was that the people you're trying to wipe out are our children who were abducted because, you know, you, the government, couldn't protect them. Now, in as far as many people think today, there are not that many Ugandan children still in the hands of LRA. So there isn't that much opposition to the military solution now. I think the impression you get is not one of people having faith in the military solution. I think it's more out of desperation.
So according to Richard, some Ugandans themselves are calling for a military solution. What's everyone's thoughts on this? Amanda?
I'm a peacemaker. A military solution is not necessarily where we look at in the first instance. As I said, we're working in northern Uganda. They want peace. They don't necessarily, from the people that we're working with, do not want a military intervention. And in Southeast Central African Republic, what we're hearing is that they also don't want a military intervention unless the sovereign state is absolutely behind it and it's done in a coordinated manner. They do not want externals coming in without themselves being involved.
The thing is, as Professor Mandani said, there's many different views, and many people would like a kind of a silver bullet solution if it was possible. In the 3 years since the peace talks collapsed, since the military offensive was launched, you've had more than 400,000 people displaced. You've had 2,400 people been killed. 3,400 people have been abducted, and of them, over 1,500 of them were children. And you had about 7,000 UPDF, that's Uganda National Army, troops chasing the LRA back in January of 2009, and now you have about 1,500 of them. So we are seeing this new regional task force being put together by the African Union, but in practice we have far fewer boots on the ground, and I think this is still kind of wishful thinking. And as Richard Kavuna just said in that broadcast, for the people for whom who are really on the front lines of this, these are their children who are abducted. And this is, in this way, as always, I mean, you know, CONI 2012 campaign have made this clear as well. They're a special case, the LRA, because when you attack them, you are also attacking abductees.
And Professor Mamdani, what are your views on this? I mean, could you tell us a bit about the impact that military intervention has had on communities in the north of Uganda?
The real reconciliation that is needed is not between the LRA and its victims. That's part of a much larger process, and that larger process is the reconciliation that has never happened here, which is between the north and the south, between the government and the population in the north. It's been 20 years of dishing out punishment to the population in the north. There are plenty of people who argue that the atrocities committed by the official forces have been just as bad, if not worse, than the atrocities of the LRA. So this is the Ugandan question is separate from this question of sending troops into the Central African Republic. You should interview people in the Central African Republic. I would be surprised if they would be in favor of this intervention.
Well, that leads us very nicely on to hearing some of those voices. Obviously, one of the biggest criticisms of the CONI 2012 video was that it gave the impression that the LRA was still active in Uganda, when in fact the LRA moved out of the country in 2006, and as you said, are now operational in the neighbouring Central African Republic, South Sudan and northeastern DRC. So let's now hear from one of those places. Father Ernest Segwele is a peace activist in Dungu, which is in northeastern DRC, and he works with Conciliation Resources.
Any means which will finish this LRA problem, but without doing more damage to people, will be welcome. As long as there is no damage done to people, or as long as there is civilian protection, there is no kidnapping, there is no killing, there is nothing, there is no damage to people, that will be welcome. But if we call it army coming, pretending to come and finish CONI, but not really finishing him, instead of finishing him, but dispatching them and making them again more worse and more dangerous and more brutal to people, that we don't accept.
Okay, so Father Segwele was saying that it's the local people who will suffer from any kind of military intervention to end the LRA conflict. Andy, you've done some research on the LRA, which has shown that different people in these very different countries where the LRA is operating want very different solutions to the problem. Is there a one-size-fits-all solution? What did your research suggest?
Of course, I suppose there isn't a one-size-fits-all solution. Maybe one of our conclusions is that local people do have the resources, the courage, the ideas, the knowledge, the know-how of their own context to bring abductees safely home. And that's been one of the, again, one of the most powerful forces degrading or eroding the power of the LRA. And they also know how to deal with those long-term challenges of reconciliation. The real accountabilities that we want to see in terms of this new regional task force and the international response is really to those local people and not to a more faceless Facebook audience.
So you're talking about empowering the local communities from the ground up to provide their own solutions to what is now a regional problem.
Listening to them, understanding their analysis, supporting their initiatives, and involving them in finding the solution to the conflict.
Yeah. Amanda, it sounds like some of your work is along the similar lines. Can you talk about how that could practically work? How can you empower communities to have the confidence to help end this conflict?
Well, I think that Andy said it all. I mean, you've got to go there and actually talk to the people and actually understand where they are coming from in real terms of, you know, how they look at the issue. You know, where do they know where their children are? Can they actually bring them back? Do they have those resources? And mentally in those terms, and we can give them other resources to assist that process. But it's a long-term solution. It's not you're humanitarian, 6 months in, get out, let the communities deal with it. It's a very long process of understanding these communities.
And do you think that those voices of people in the countries that are directly affected by the LRA, do you think that they are being heard in this debate?
I don't really think so. I think that there's a lot more that could be done with agencies like ourselves to actually get that message out, and that's a key part of why we need to be in Southeast Central African Republic.
And Professor Mandani, what are your thoughts on this? Do you believe that the solution lies with the communities in the regions affected by the conflict?
I think the solution has to be mainly political, and I think it has to be a non-military solution. I think that the solution requires the creation of a credible and durable political order in this society. And I think we have a lot of experience since 1986 in doing that. If you simply take note of the fact that Idi Amin's vice president is a high official in the contemporary government of Uganda, you would recognize that there are different ways of dealing with atrocities.
Do you believe that this conflict calls for a regional solution?
I don't think so. I think it's been regionalized. I think this is a conflict which calls mainly for a Ugandan solution. I think if the amnesty bill is fully implemented in this country, that would be the end of the conflict. Unfortunately, this conflict is being regionalized. If this goes on for some time, it's not going to be any longer within the control of local forces. The real issue is not Kony. Kony is 200 people. If Kony was not there, Kony would have to be invented. And the real problem is not Kony. The real problem is the militarization of this region by forces, both external and internal to the region.
Thank you. Amanda, I think you wanted to jump in there.
Yeah, I think I agree with what the professor is saying. And again, from our experience of Southeast Central African Republic, a lot of the banditry that is happening, just general banditry, they are taking the name of the LRA and intimidating communities into thinking that they are the real LRA. But the hierarchies aren't there. The way in which that Kony was working when he was at his peak, it was very militaristic. There was a hierarchy.
Andy?
I think in many parts of the world we see that conflicts aren't respecting boundaries and borders, and this is one of them. And yet the international diplomatic system is very much obviously state-based. So the LRA aren't a big priority in any one of those four governments, but it is a very important issue for the world, and we've got to credit Invisible Children for having raised that profile. I think what the professor is saying is correct, and yet I would also say it does require a regional response.
So let's hear from one of the readers of the Global Development website.
Hi, I'm Tom. I'm a Guardian reader from the United States, and I wanted to know what will happen if Kony and the LRA are in fact brought to justice. Does the governments in Central Africa have the resources to prevent further groups from springing up?
Amanda and Andy, do you agree?
this is kind of fantasy football, though, that we, you know, if they were successful, what would then happen? Do they have the resources to prevent other groups from springing up? No. The other group, there are other armed groups. There's a number of groups operating in that region. And the situation in the security context is actually worsening. We're looking at a terrible situation in South Sudan now with the erupting conflict with the north. I think also that the one thing we have spoken about a bit has been about the discipline and the problems they have with their own security forces, that they continue to commit abuses. So as long as those conditions continue, there will be insecurity in that region. But in terms of the fantasy question, if they were taken out, would it end the LRA? I think it would end the LRA.
Amanda, what do you think might step into this vacuum if the LRA is disbanded?
I think that what we're more concerned about is banditry and large groups of bandits going to slash and burn communities as they did when there was the famine in South Sudan in 98 and that ongoing conflict. And again, I agree with Andy that South Sudan is rather a hub for this and it has to be controlled. And it's how do you teach bandits that there are boundaries?
Can you clarify that a bit? How might that work? How can you get those communities to stand up and fight back?
Again, it's a long-term issue. It's not your humanitarian 6 months in, 6 months out. You have to have people, either political or regional, as Andy says, and with the states actually listening to what communities require and how they can actually protect themselves.
Well, one thing we're doing is we're supporting a network of civic actors and leaders who formed themselves into something called the Regional Civil Society Task Force. And one thing they've done is that they've created exchanges between Uganda and DRC and Central African Republic and South Sudan. So people in the newly affected communities can talk to people in communities that have been dealing with it, the same phenomena for the last 10, 15 years and hear from them about their tactics and strategies and learn from that.
Do you think one of the legacies of the Kony 2012 campaign might be that there's more pressure on the governments themselves to help protect communities against attacks by the LRA and other rebel groups?
I don't think yet. I think that's what these kind of conversations are leading to. I think there's some pressure in Europe and America. I don't think that the governments of the four countries affected are feeling a pressure to protect their citizens.
Which obviously leads us on to the longer term perspective. It's easy to unite behind a campaign to rescue child soldiers, but let's presume that Kony is apprehended. What next? In a few years, these children will be adults struggling to put their lives back together. And what will happen to these children if they don't receive the long-term support that they so desperately need? So, Amanda, I guess, what happens to young people when they leave the LRA?
Poverty is one of the issues, that they go back into a situation of poverty, which puts them into a position of risk within their communities. And again, a lot of the NGOs working with these communities are trying to not only offer vocational training and education. Certainly we do some psychosocial, very minor sort of psychosocial stuff in terms of life skills training, how to be a good citizen, what it means to be part of your community and how to grow within your community, and then how to either be a leader within your community. So they will be the farmers, the teachers, the heads of their communities, and we try and give those skills.
And do you believe that kind of support, that kind of one-on-one psycho support or counselling, do you think that really is needed in order to help these young people recover from their experiences?
Yeah, I think it's really important that they actually get to talk about it. In academic terms, we don't really know what the impact of that is, but anecdotal evidence shows that it's a very good way of allowing the children, young people, to integrate back into their societies and working with the rest of the communities for the communities to accept these young people back into them.
Are there problems with them? What kind of emotional scars are left by the experiences that these children have gone through? Are they facing great stigma?
If you work with them, and again, it's a long-term project, they're very proud of where they've come from. You know, they consider themselves survivors. They are very upright and knowledgeable about what they've done, how they've done, where they've been, and And they're very proud of that they've come out of it and being able to be given the opportunity to actually move forward within their lives. They're very resilient.
Andy, would you agree?
In the new regions where kids are being affected in these different countries, I mean, it's a region, the area size of England, mostly we don't see, we just don't see enough, do we? And it's not there for long enough, and they're not able to access the communities, or they tend to be in some of the hubs, but not actually out and into the communities, because it's too insecure, and you don't have the infrastructure to do it. These people, the needs don't, they're not just immediate needs, they're long-term needs for returnees and ex-combatants. And, you look, one place to look is in Uganda, as we said, where the war has moved, where it's moved on. Are those ex-combatants now, have they received the support that they need? And there's all kinds of complex issues. You know, should they be receiving a preferential treatment to those who weren't abducted? Some of the young people I've met who really grew up within the ranks of the LRA see themselves as combatants, as ex-soldiers, not as civilians.
Professor Mamdani, do you believe that anything good can come from Kony 2012's massive globalisation of awareness and opinion that can make a real and lasting difference to these communities on the ground?
Of course something good can come out of it. If people realise, you know, what's the real motive of groups like these, this is more of an advertising, fundraising campaign than it is anything else. We saw that with the Congo. We saw that with all the estimates, inflated estimates by NGOs in Congo about the numbers of people dead, which hiked up the amounts of money they were able to raise. So people have to understand that the agencies which raise these questions have their own interests. And if Kony 2012 is going to educate the population in Uganda and outside to tell apart the interests of these agencies from the issues they're pointing to, that's great. Secondly, if Kony 2012 is going to get us to discuss the Kony question in greater depth so that we can actually arrive at some kind of a solution, not the solution that the Invisible Children is pointing to, that's also great.
So the same question to both of you. What next? Can Kony 2012 have a lasting difference to this conflict?
Firstly, I think that the phenomenon that was Kony 2012, media PhDs are going to be held on this, how did it go viral, why, etc., etc. Whatever happens with any of these videos, a percentage of those people will look at what the deeper causes are. And because we've had 100 million hits on that particular video, the percentage in terms of numbers will be higher. And I agree with the professor that that is a positive thing. Is it right that Kony goes to the ICC? I think we've discussed that, and the answer is yes. But it's a long-term solution. It's not necessarily about Kony. It's about the children, young people, and the communities that they come from. And we've got a long way to go, but the debate has started, and I think that's a really positive thing.
Andy?
Yeah, I'm sure that it has done much more good than harm in terms of stirring up so much interest in this conflict. You know, when the film first went out on YouTube, I at the breakfast table was talking to my 16-year-old daughter who had seen it before I had and wasn't even aware that I'd been working on the issue since the late 90s. I think that what's really good is that we're going to see interest more, we hope, from politicians and not just leave it in the hands of the armies to deal with the problem. And I hope that means that the UN and the AU's special envoys and the European Union special envoy will be mandated to take an interest to look for a political solution.
Is there not a danger, though, that there's, because of this massive mobilisation, there's now a lot of political pressure in the US to provide this very quick solution?
I suppose we've seen that even the most powerful nation on earth, though, can't have that kind of power when it comes to defeating rebel forces. And they have 100 special forces on the ground. You know, they do have drones. They are using their technology. But we don't see tanks on the ground. And we're not seeing that kind of response. I don't think there's a risk of that. I think the biggest risk, as we said, is that the people who are shouldering the risks are not the Facebook readers and the YouTube watchers. You know, it is local communities. That is the biggest risk. That it simply will not work.
Well, that's all for this Guardian Focus podcast. For more on development issues, visit guardian.co.uk/global development. My thanks to Professor Mandani, Andy Cull and Amanda Weisbaum. I'm Annie Kelly and the producer was Celeste Hicks.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.